Welcome to another episode of Let Go and Lead, where we discuss the new realities of leadership with pioneers, provocateurs, and passionate leadership champions. Today's guest is a top-selling author, leadership coach, thought leader, and the CEO of Disruption Advisors. Whitney Johnson is most known for her work around the disruption theory and the famous S-curve of learning, which highlights how people build skills and competencies over time. She's also written several best-selling books, including Smart Growth, Build an A-Team, and Disrupt Yourself. Since part of the Let Go and Lead framework is an idea called Fueling Perpetual Reinvention, I know Whitney and I are going to have a great conversation. So get comfortable and get ready to let go and lead. So today we're with Whitney Johnson. Whitney, thanks so much for joining us. I'm so excited about your background. And, you know, you're not only a best-selling author, you're a leadership coach, but also the CEO of Disruption Advisors, which I love the whole concept of that. We're going to have a lot to talk about.
Wonderful. Well, I'm really happy to be here. Thank you for having me, Meryl.
Absolutely. So as we said, you're known for work around your disruption theory, but I'd love to start talking a little bit about your background on Wall Street. And I saw in your bio that you talk about applying the understanding of momentum and growth of stocks to growth of people. I thought that was really interesting. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
As you noted, I started my career on Wall Street. I was working in investment banking, but then moved to equity research. And when you're in equity research, your job is to build financial models and then to make a call as to whether you think a stock is a buy or a sell. And so I did that and I was very successful. I was an institutional investor ranked analyst. But then I had this experience where we were doing a training of a number of my sell-side analyst colleagues. And this was early 2000s. It's the apex of American Idol. I've just read the book or the article, A Brand Called You by Tom Peters. And so we're doing this workshop of training the analysts. And I find myself asking them, well, if you were a brand, what would you be? Are you, you know, the comeback kid? Are you the forensic analyst? Are you the earnings guru? And just thinking about them and where they were and what their momentum was. And I discovered that I was fascinated not only with spotting, is this stock going to go up? Is it going to go down? Because stocks do have a personality. I found that I was even more interested in what's happening with this person. What's the momentum? What's the trajectory of their career? And so I basically took that understanding of momentum around stocks and found that I was even more interested in investing and understanding the momentum around people.
You know, I think what you just described is so interesting, and I'm curious. Do you see a correlation between the personality of a stock and the personality of a person?
That's a really great question. I don't know that I've ever thought about that. But what I would say is that just as with people, we start to have patterns of behavior and they're sort of tells about what they'll do in certain situations. My experience with stocks was that there were some similarities that over time you could have a sense of how a stock would react to a certain piece of news. And so there were some patterns, some predictive patterns with stocks that are very similar to being able to predict the behavior of a person.
What's behind the pattern of a stock? Is that the leadership of the company or is it the way the market reacts to it?
It's more the way the market reacts.
So
So it's more of, you know, after you're watching it for a while and you're analyzing it and thinking about it, you start to see, okay, so because you've got at any given time, you've got individuals that are in a stock, but then you've also got institutions, and that's fluid, but they're there for a while. And so after a while, you start to analyze, oh, I bet you the stock's going to react this way with this piece of news, or I bet the stock's going to react this way when this macroeconomic event happens. And so it's not the leadership, but it's how the market will respond to the news and therefore move the stock in one direction or another.
I've never thought about this either, but it is true too. As people, we respond to others' expectations of us as well. Yeah, so that's just a very interesting analogy. Yeah. So you were, tell me about what happened. So you were at Wall Street, you started getting interested in people, as personalities, not just stocks. And then what happened?
So 2004, 2005, so actually almost 20 years ago now, I was interested in the people piece. And then I also read The Innovator's Dilemma by Clayton Christensen and found myself really intrigued by this idea and thinking of disruption as this way to understand what was going on in the emerging markets, which was wireless was disrupting wireline, which is why every quarter they were beating my estimates because the disruption was happening faster than expected. But then I had this experience where I had gone to my manager and said, you know, I'd really like to do something different. And they said, effectively, we like you right where you are. And so now I've read The Innovator's Dilemma. I've thought about this disruption. I've had this kernel of an idea that it's not just products and services that disrupt, that it's also people. And so that was this thought of, if I'm going to do what I feel like I need to do on this planet, which I don't know what it is yet, but I have this sense that there's more, I'm going to have to step away from this opportunity where I am on Wall Street with a really good job. I'm going to have to disrupt myself and do something new. And so it was 2004, 2005, I disrupted myself. I left Wall Street. I left this really good paying job to go become an entrepreneur. And there were lots of fits and starts and things that worked and things that didn't work, mostly didn't work. But then this bug hit me of like, I actually really want to explore. I don't want to think about investing. I want to think about people. And so I wrote an article called Disrupt Yourself in Harvard Business Review. And that was really the beginning. This is 2012, the beginning of me on this journey, this massive disruption that I did of moving from investing to building a human capital firm where we're looking at how do we help people grow? How do we get teams from point A to point B and using our S-curve framework to do that?
Yeah, and your article led to a book. You have several books, but that led to a book by that name, Disrupt Yourself, which I absolutely love. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the S-curve?
I would love to. So we were using the S-curve in investing. And it was, the S-curve was popularized by Everett Rogers, the sociologist, and he used it to understand how groups change over time, how quickly a product might be adopted. And we were using it in our investing to say, okay, how quickly will adoption of whatever product it is we're looking at will happen? But now you've sensed a pattern that I'm always thinking about, how do you take this theory and tie it back to people? And so that started this journey of, okay, if the S-curve can help us understand how individuals change, what does that look like? And so there are three major parts of the S-curve. There's the launch point, there's the sweet spot, there's mastery. It answers questions like, why is it so hard to start something new? Why, once you do start, is it easy? And why can you be really good at something and feel like you can no longer keep doing it? That's because you're at the top of the S. And when you understand those different phases, the launch point, sweet spot, master, you also understand that at the launch point, you're going to feel overwhelmed and discouraged and frustrated and impatient and like an imposter. But when you know that, you can say, okay, it's not that growth isn't happening. It is, but it feels slow. But this is normal. This is how I'm supposed to feel when I do something new. It also explains like when you get into the sweet spot, why you're exhilarated. It's because you feel like you're in flow. You're on that steep part of the curve because you're not only growing quickly, but you can see that you are growing quickly. And then in mastery, what happens is that you have figured it out. You've accomplished what you came to do. You're at the top of the mountain. You like everything, you know, sort of master of the universe, if you will. But your brain says, learning is the oxygen of human growth. And if I stay here, this plateau will become a precipice. And so knowing that growth is our default setting, our brain says, you need to go do something new. You need to jump to a new S-curve. You need to disrupt yourself. You need to start all over again. But now you understand the emotional piece that you're going to feel all along the curve.
And for those who are wondering, explain, why is it an S?
That's a great question. So what happened with Everett Rogers when he was looking at the adoption is that it's a standard bell curve, but basically what happens is that at the bottom, the growth looks very slow, so that's flat. And then once you hit the stage of hypergrowth, the growth accelerates. So you go, it's steep and sleek. And then once you start to reach saturation, the growth tapers off.
So it's sort of the, like you hit the hump and then you go up and then taper again.
You start flat where it feels like nothing's happening, but it is. Then you hit the tipping point that Malcolm Gladwell popularized and goes zoop, steep, hyper growth, fast, fast, fast. And then it flattens out. And if you tie it back to Roger's adoption curve, what it means is initially there are very few people that adopt the idea, but then you hit this point of 10 to 15% have adopted it. And then you hit hyper growth and then you reach saturation. And then the rate of adoption starts to slow. And that's the other side of the bell curve.
Thank you. And I know that you also talk about the 7 accelerants of personal disruption that are kind of related, right?
Yes, absolutely. So one of the things that we've done is we've created a tool that will allow you to say, okay, so where am I in my growth? So basically, where am I on the S curve? Am I at the launch point, the sweet spot in mastery? So where am I on the mountain? Because when I know where I am on the mountain, that helps me know how I'm going to navigate this and how it's going to feel, and I know what's next. But then the 7 accelerants, sometimes I call them accelerants of personal disruption, are the tools that you put in your backpack that are going to allow you to scale that mountain and do it effectively. So the piece that you're going to have control over. And so there are 7 of them, and I'll go through them very quickly. The first one is you take the right risks. It's a willingness to play where you haven't played before and where other people aren't playing, to focus on how can I create rather than competing with people. The second one is play to your distinctive strengths. Is you need to be willing to play and do what makes you feel strong. Sometimes we don't want to do the things that make us feel strong because we want to do hard things, things that will make us feel like we're valuable. And yet you're going to always be able to scale that mountain faster if you're willing to recognize what you do well and own what you do well and value what you do well. And then it becomes this flywheel of, I feel strong, so I'm willing to play where I haven't played, to take the right risks. Number 3 is you embrace your constraints. So you think, if only I had more time or more money or more expertise, then I could really get up this mountain quickly. But the fact is, we know that it's a law of physics even, that you need to have constraints. You need something to bump up against that's going to allow you to move up. So look at your constraints, embrace them, because they're actually a tool of creation for you. Then number 4 is examine your expectations. We talked earlier about stocks and what happens with stocks. Well, oftentimes stocks will meet the estimates of what people are expecting, but when they don't meet those estimates, and even if they don't beat those estimates, then the stock goes down. And so you want to think about, as you're managing an S curve, it's really this exercise in managing your expectations, of not having too high of expectations at the launch, of giving yourself grace. In the sweet spot, they're sort of in line. But in mastery, you don't have high enough expectations. And so you need to have more expectations for yourself so that you'll go do something new. But as you manage those, then you have that emotional regulation that you need in order to scale the curve. Number 5, step back in order to slingshot forward. Sometimes you have to be willing to take a different job, move to a new city, take less pay in order to do what you felt like you want to do. So it's the step back to move forward. Number 6 is to give failure its due, to recognize that failure is a constraint. So it's something that can teach us. It can become a tool of creation. Oftentimes we feel shame when we fail, which requires us to do some inner work. But in fact, that if we can ditch the shame, it's the failure that can become this catalyst for us really moving up the curve. And then number 7 is to be driven by discovery. At the top of the curve, the bottom of the curve, everywhere in between, is to ask yourself, okay, I took a step forward. Now I'm going to get some feedback and then I'm going to adapt. And we know that 70% of all successful new businesses ended up in a place completely different than where they started. And why would it be any different for us? And so when we're discovery driven, then we'll figure out, we might be on the wrong S curve initially, but we'll eventually find the right S curve for us. And so those are 7 tools that you put in your backpack that can help you move up the curve more effectively.
It's so interesting, because I was on a panel discussion last night and it was around what it means to be an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. And I was talking about many of these things, but you described them so beautifully and in such a connected way, where I was more just speaking from experience. So I love that. What do you think is the thing people most need to disrupt in themselves?
Their mindset, how we think about the world. Because you and I can talk about this and think, yeah, I'm going to disrupt myself. Yeah, I'm going to do something new. Yeah, I'm going to do that. And yet we have these really thick neural pathways. There are these, you know, this S curve of this is how I've done it, this comfortable routine, this highway of habit. And we may not even like what it looks like, but it's just so comfortable. And it's just so, we're almost unaware of it. And yet if we're going to actually move along an S curve quickly and move along new S curves, we have to be, you know, as Marshall Goldsmith, a wonderful influencer for me, said, what got you here won't get you there. And so we have to disrupt how are we thinking about things. I'll give you a very simple example. You've got a podcast, I've got a podcast. And about 2 years ago, I said to a group of my friends, you know, I'd really like to have Ed Catmull on my podcast. So he's one of the founders of Pixar. And I immediately then said, oh, but he won't do it. And my friends and my family, we were actually on a vacation together. They said to me, well, how do you know? Have you asked him? No, but he won't do it. And so then they, in that moment, dared me to ask him if he will come on your podcast. And guess what? He did. And so, but the mindset was there. I had to disrupt my mindset. Now, it's true that there will be people that I will ask that will not necessarily or have not yet come on. Like if I, you know, Tim Ferriss, for example. But here's the thing. When you ask, even that willingness to ask, you have disrupted your mindset. You've said, I believe this is possible. I believe this makes sense. You're creating a different world. You're creating a different paradigm for yourself. So for me, one of the things that I have worked on the most over the last 5 years is, what's going on in my mind? How do I disrupt my mindset? Because if I can disrupt how I'm thinking about the world, if I believe it, then I can, if I believe that something is possible, then I can make it possible.
I'm so relating to this because I remember when I first asked Howard Schultz to do my podcast, I was not expecting him to do it. And he did it. And then I asked Mitch Albom, and then I asked Marshall Goldsmith. And, you know, it's been really, it is like a vicious cycle, as you say. Yeah. Like you just have to get yourself, get that flywheel going. So
you did the same thing, Meryl. You're like, oh, I don't know if they'll do it. But you're like, I'm just going to ask. And then they said yes.
It was like, all right, I'm going to try. And when I heard he'd said yes, I was like, what? And of course, what you learn too is the more you ask and the more people you get going, then other people come because they, oh, Howard Schultz was on the podcast.
That's right. You're right. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Right. Exactly. And now I can tell people Whitney Johnson was on the podcast. You need to come too. So tell me a little bit about what you're doing with your company and some of the consulting that you're doing around disruption.
Yeah. So this has been, you know, talk about new S-curves, being at the launch point of an S-curve where, so our company is called Disruption Advisors. As I said, we, you know, help you get from point A to point B. We do that by initially giving you some inspiration of here's why you might want to do something differently. Here's why it makes sense to try to work more cohesively as a team, for example, or for you just as a leader to be more effective. But then we have this wonderful tool, it's called the S-Curve Insight Tool, that allows you as an individual, but also on your team, to look at where do I perceive I am in my growth? Do I think that I'm at the launch point, the sweet spot, or in mastery? And it helps me get a read and orient myself. Where am I? How well am I using these different accelerants that you and I just talked about? And then there's the ecosystem where, you know, are the conditions conducive to growth? So I need to climb this mountain and I have to do it by myself, but I can't do it alone. Are there people around me that are going to help me grow? And so it gets a read on or a beat on the culture that you're working with. So now you've got this insight as a team of where are individuals in their growth. If you're a manager, you can look at where are all my various people in their growth. And then that allows us to really do some great work around helping you change the culture, helping you collaborate and work more effectively as a team. It helps you have tools around talent development because you now have a language to talk about growth. And so we have this tool that allows you to do this. We certify coaches and leaders inside of organizations who want to be able to use this to really be able to talk to their people and have this common language to talk about growth and development.
You talk a lot about smart growth also, and you wrote a book with that name. What is that different than the S-curve, or it's the same concept?
It's the same concept. So Meryl, here's the background. I had written Disrupt Yourself, which was about how do you disrupt yourself? And then Build an A-Team was using these ideas to build a high-performing team. In both books, I had the S-curve, but it was kind of in the background. It was sort of running the script in the background. And I remember when Build an A-Team came out, I was having a conversation with Dan Peek, who, is amazing. And he was going to interview me and he's like, well, what do you want to talk about? And I threw out like 10 different ideas. And finally he said, why aren't we just talking about the S-curve? That is interesting. And I realized, the S-curve's been in the background. The S-curve's been the supporting actor. But in fact, the S-curve should be the main actor, the lead actor. And so Smart Growth was really a focus on, let's put the S-curve front and center. Let's analyze this. I made this vast intuitive leap, but let's really look at the neuroscience. Let's look at the biology. Let's look at the mathematics behind this and have this robust body of work so that people could really use this framework and model in their work. So it's an expansion of, it's meant to give people the real tools that they need in order to grow effectively and to grow in a smart way.
So Whitney, I'd love to ask you about the LinkedIn Live event that you did with Seth Godin when you guys were talking about the BIB defenders. And of course, Seth is always so good at just quipping these phrases. He was another one of my guests that was amazing. Just tell the story of the BIB defenders and the conclusion you guys came to.
Isn't that fun? I was like, BIB defenders, what are those? Well, so what he was sharing is that there's been this whole hullabaloo around people who are running or track and field of, they've got this really high tech performance clothing, but then they want them to wear these bibs that they pin on with safety pins.
Yeah, the big paper bibs.
Yeah, they pin on with safety pins. And they've come up with a solution that would allow people to be able to track them. I think he said they're RFID chips, and it solves the problem, period. But there are a lot of people who are defending this old way of doing it. I don't remember he said why, but that they should continue to wear the bibs and they should continue to have the safety pins on. And I thought that was so powerful. And it's such a great metaphor for when we want to do something new and when we're trying to introduce something new, there are going to be bib defenders in our lives. And what are we going to do to be able to diffuse that? And do you want me to share with you what I said?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah. So basically when he shared that story with me, my thought was, okay, this is interesting. What I would say is that whenever you make a decision to disrupt yourself, whenever you make a decision to jump to a new S curve, by definition, the people around you are also disrupted because you changed, they're disrupted because you jumped to a new S curve. They at some level have to jump to a new S curve, especially the people closest to you. So your closest colleagues, your family, et cetera. And so what I have found is that when that happens, when the bib defenders start defending, usually it's because they don't understand what's happening and they're a little bit scared. They're just saying, but that means things will be different. And I don't know what it's going to look like when things are different. And I don't know what I will do with that. So I just want it to be how it was. And so the more we can understand that, the more we can be aware of it, the more the bib defenders will stop defending the bib. But we have to hold space for them to be a little bit afraid. I just had this interesting situation come up in the last couple of months where two friends of mine, the husband just got this great job offer to go somewhere else, change schools. And the wife was like, I like my life. We've built out a life here. I don't want to move. And his getting this great job, it's fantastic, but it was going to completely upend her life, completely disrupt her life. And so, I gave her an opportunity to talk through this and wanted to bear witness to the loss that she was feeling. But one of the things that I said to her and to him as well, but mostly to her, you two need to have this conversation about the experience that you are having, how you feel, how disrupted you feel, and that you are willing to entertain this, but you have to figure this out together because this is really difficult. And I don't know how to do this, and I don't know what this looks like. It's incumbent on both parties to do that. But I think when we understand, again, people are defending the bib because they're afraid that they're going to lose something that feels important to them. And if you can go past that defensiveness and really start to understand what's happening without you yourself getting defensive, like, why don't they love me? This doesn't make sense. This is super logical. Of course we should do this. That will allow you to have those conversations that will get you to a place that feels good and comfortable to both parties, and they can take off the bib.
I'm curious what you think of this, that in my experience, I found it's also really important to talk to people about what's not going to change.
Oh, I love that.
And what'll stay the same.
I love that. Yes, that's so good. So basically what you're saying, Meryl, is that you would say, okay, let me talk to you about, oh, that's so good, five things that are going to change and the five things that are not going to change. Like, I still love you. I still, you know, like all those things. That's terrific.
Yeah, working with companies a lot, you know, especially when there's a strategy shift or a culture change or a merger, we talk a lot about these are the things that will stay the same. And from there, here's where we're springboarding to what's going to change. Yeah.
Yeah, I love that.
As you look ahead at like the emerging societal trends in the workforce, what trends are you hearing from companies and leaders that you coach?
Well, they're certainly grappling with remote and hybrid work. And what does that look like? That's something that I think everyone is grappling with. And it's interesting. I think one of the things that we need to do when we're grappling with challenges like that is to go back to fundamental principles and basics of, okay, what do humans need? You know, they need the nurturing, they need the connectedness, they need the tools that they need to do the job. So as you're thinking about the ecosystem that I talked about in our tool, but we do have to grapple with the remote work. We have to grapple with the hybrid work. What does that look like? Because you do have business needs. You need to build a business, but you also have people who are without whom you don't have a business. So what does that look like? I'm obviously fascinated by ChatGPT and what that can mean, and how by harnessing that we can become more effective and more efficient. And yes, there will be some displacement that takes place, but that's part of the reason why personal disruption is so important, is because if you can disrupt yourself, if you can grow, then you're going to find ways of how do I use technological advancements in order to accelerate my growth as opposed to being overcome by those advancements. I think the third thing, and this is just probably more topical right now, is that we're in the middle of an economic downturn, and a lot of the CEOs that I'm coaching at the moment are grappling with, how do I run my business when things are tough? And how do I make sure that people stay motivated? And how do I make sure they're motivated even when I have to lay a lot of people off? And so all those questions that I think people are trying to wrestle with and manage.
What are you seeing as some of the best solutions to those?
Well, it will come as no surprise to you, probably the two things I'm going to say. I just had a conversation the other day with a leader who, a CEO, their business has taken a real nosedive and they have to figure out how they're going to cut costs. And it's very easy to just look at how we're going to, you know, how do we take costs out of the business? And we had this conversation where we said, let's go back to your people, to all of their people. Let's start with, are there some people that don't actually want to be here anymore, that are ready to go to jump to a new curve? Because that's a way to cut costs and also for them to be happier. And so give them a good package. So that's a way to solve it. But to really, I guess the big picture piece that I'm saying and seeing is that when they will take that moment and think about, all right, I understand I need to cut costs, but let me start with my people. Where are my people on their curves? Who might it be time for them to leave? Who might it be time for them to step up? How can I bring them together and read them in on what we're trying to work through and ask them to be a part of the solution? And so what I would say is that's the first thing, is that they're leaning into the people as a resource and to understand where they are in their growth and how can you help them grow maybe with you or somewhere else. That's the first thing. The second thing that I am finding that is effective is that I had another CEO that I was working with who, when things start to be tough, they start to withdraw. They start to revert to old behaviors. They pull back because they're scared. And what I saw one CEO, and we sort of coached through this and him do very effectively, is this is not the time to withdraw. This is the time to display humility. This is the time to say to your board of directors and to your senior leaders, here's where we are. Here's what I think we need to do, but let's sit down and talk about this. And I need your advice. I need your help. I need you to work with me to be able to move this forward. So I'd say those are the two things that I'm thinking of is like to, instead of just focusing on costs, focus on your people, because you're going to get a lot of solutions as you think about your people. And then number two, instead of withdrawing, the ones that are willing to lean in and create that community and ask for the help from the people that they want to shy away from because they don't want to say that the numbers are bad, but they all know the numbers are bad, and asking for that help and bringing them along as partners in finding the solution to move through this very challenging economic scenario that we're in.
So talk to me a little bit about the experience you had in coaching that individual who was trying to withdraw. What is it that you did or said to him that helped him to lean in?
It was time for me to do a check-in with his stakeholders. So we do stakeholder-centered coaching, which is from Marshall Goldsmith. And I had done a check-in with the stakeholders, and they were telling me they were concerned about him because they deeply care about this person. So they were concerned. And they said, you know, he's not listening to us. And so I asked for permission to share what they shared with me because, you know, they're supposed to be confidential, but I asked for permission. And when I got that permission, I was able to go to him and say, here's what's happening. Here's the experience that they're having. Here, you're losing them. You need to have these conversations. It was very difficult because he felt it was just difficult to have that conversation because it was sort of your soul is laid bare. But because I had gotten that really direct feedback and I could say that to him and he knew that I cared deeply about him, then he was able to hear it and to do something about it and then go back to the stakeholders and have those conversations and start to move forward. So it was, I got the feedback, I shared it, I got permission to share it, I held the space where he knew that he was deeply cared for. That allowed him to ingest it. And then we could talk through together, okay, so what do you want to do next? But I do think one of the big generalizable things here is that as a coach, you can only say those kinds of things if the person knows that you deeply, deeply care about them and you will hold that space and it is a very safe space for them.
You know, I think sometimes people forget that leadership can be a really lonely space and that leaders need psychological safety too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
So Whitney, talk a little bit about how one's personal disruption really helps one be a better leader.
Yeah, it's a great question. So let me share with you a study that came out a couple years ago that I found fascinating. So Egon Zehnder polled 1,000 CEOs and they asked them the question, do you believe that to transform your organization, you need to transform yourself? And this is pre-pandemic and only 28% of these leaders strongly agreed with that statement. Well, 2 years later, they readministered the survey and they found that now 80% of them strongly agreed that if you're going to transform your organization, you need to transform yourself. And so the question is, how does it help you do this? Well, first of all, if you are inviting the people on your team and you're inviting your organization to change, if you are changing yourself, you have the moral authority to ask other people to change, which is very, very important. Then there's the more practical piece of, as you are trying to grow an organization, as you are trying to, in real time, solve the challenges that are facing your organization, you need to be willing to change. How am I thinking about this problem? How am I solving this? What do I need to do differently? Do I need to improve my emotional regulation? Do I need to manage my stress better? Do I need to get more sleep? And so when you as a leader are willing to figure out, what do I need to do to be more effective? What do I need to do to have better conversations with my people, to think more strategically about the business? All of those things, that is personal disruption. That is stepping back from who you are to slingshot into who you can be. And as you're willing and able to disrupt yourself, you're not only equipping yourself, but because of the contagion effect, you are giving everybody around you permission to disrupt themselves and to change. And as you change and you grow and the people around you change and grow, then what will happen to your organization? It will change and grow. So again, the moral authority, but the contagion effect, and then just that real-time response to, I need to change. If I change, then everything around me will be able to change and move forward.
And I think too, as people are disrupting themselves, they create a lot of energy that is infectious also.
Yeah. So this is that energy, that contagion. I think there was this great research study that said that if you are happier, then your child will be happier, your child's teacher will be happier, and your child's teacher's partner will be happier. So the same would also apply of, if you disrupt yourself, then your EA will disrupt themselves, and then your EA's colleague will disrupt themselves, and then their boss will disrupt themselves. So that energy, that kinetic energy that takes place by your decision to change, to disrupt yourself, it those small things, oh, it's not a big deal if I, you know, have a crucial conversation, all of a sudden it aggregates to very big, massive, positive disruptions very quickly.
In your experience, what have you seen that leaders most need to let go of?
Their ego. You know, I talked earlier about managing expectations of, you know, as you move along the curve, and it's a willingness to say, okay, I think things should be like this, or I think I should be able to do X, Y, or Z. But it's that willingness to let the ego go, willingness to be able to make mistakes, to not feel shame around those, and just to say, we tried this and it didn't work. And what did we learn? And I'm not going to shame myself or anybody else. And now let's just move forward. What's the ROI on this mistake? And so I think I put myself in this example, when I can take my ego off the table, when a leader can take their ego off the table and just be in this place of deep learning and deep appreciation for everybody you're working with, then you can move forward. You can deal with anything that comes your way.
Well, Whitney, thank you so much. This has been an incredible conversation. I'm so glad that you joined us on Let Go and Lead.
Thank you for having me, Meryl.
That was such an interesting conversation about disruption. A key aspect of Whitney's focus is applying the S-curve model to better understand how individuals change and grow. Whitney explained the 7 accelerants of personal disruption, which are: take the right risks, play to your distinctive strengths, embrace your constraints, examine your expectations, step back in order to slingshot forward, give failure its due, and be driven by discovery. We spent a lot of time during our conversation talking about the personal benefits of disrupting ourselves. But Whitney also emphasized that disrupting ourselves can make us better leaders and help the organization overall. She said that if you're willing and able to disrupt yourself, you're giving everyone around you permission to disrupt themselves and change too. As I do with all my guests, I asked Whitney what we should let go of to be better leaders. She said that when leaders can take their ego off the table and allow themselves to be in a place of deep learning and appreciation for everyone they're working with, they can move forward and deal with anything that comes their way. I love that answer, and I've seen the impact of this among many leaders I've known over the course of my career. Don't forget to hit subscribe so that you're always reminded when a new episode of Let Go and Lead is released. You'll not want to miss this upcoming season, which also includes insightful interviews with Amy Edmondson, Mark Crowley, Scott Snook, and Zach Mercurio. I wish each of you good luck with your own personal disruption. See you on the next episode of Let Go and Lead.